If you're watching a shell game, you are probably the only person who is not in on the shell game. If you're there and you're watching it and they're allowing you to watch it, you're the person they're after.
Every week I'm sent a video of someone playing the shell game. Maybe it's a cat finding a single treat under three cups. Maybe it's a magician wowing audiences with hand-carved replica walnuts and a tiny silicon pea. And yet, despite being one of the most famous scams in the world, the shell game is also one of the most misunderstood. Even the name is misleading. The shell game. But it's rarely performed with actual shells, and it definitely isn't a game. It's a scam through and through. One that you're never going to win. Every year, tourists around the world lose hundreds of thousands of dollars on this simple wager. On this episode of Scammapalooza, I talk to Nick Stein, aka the Crooked Croupier, about how the scam works, why it's so profitable, and why, despite being as famous as it is, does it still take in so much money. If you're enjoying the podcast, please tell your friends or leave a review. Your support is the only way I can keep making these. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. I was very excited to discover your existence, that there was not only another Nick, but another Nick who is as equally obsessed with the shell game as as I am.
It's a small world.
It is a small world. We should start a club of Nicks who are interested in the shell game.
It's very niche, isn't it?
It is niche. It is, but it seems to be a growing community of amateur shell game aficionados, because the game itself has been played for centuries. But I keep bumping into people like yourself who are, you know, like obsessed with this one tiny game and how it works. How did you first discover the shell game? Do you remember?
To be honest with you, I think I've always sort of been aware of it from my childhood, basically. It's featured in cartoons often and things. So I was aware of the idea or the concept. The first times I really saw the shell game live in action, once was on Jubilee Bridge in London, just off South Bank. So I saw a group of shell gamers playing the game there, and I was fascinated by it. I started as a magician in my career and also as a street performer. So I was passing them by on the way to Covent Garden to do my shows, and I was watching them drawing crowds and what I thought at the time was entertaining the audience with this sort of mini cups and balls trick. I learned very quickly that wasn't quite the case.
And that confusion is common. Like, people aren't always 100% sure what the shell game is and how it's different from, you mentioned, the cups and balls. And sometimes the cups and balls is confused with the shell game and also with three card Monty. They kind of all get lumped into this one category, which as a performer, I find it sometimes frustrating to try and draw the distinction. But I imagine if you're a con artist trying to scam people, that confusion would probably help, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think there are a number of things happening there. One, it looks so innocent, but it also looks so simple. Three objects, one of them has a ball underneath it, or three cards or whatever. And so therefore, they all look similar, all the different versions, Disc Monty and Three Card Monty and the shell game or a cups and balls trick performed by a magician. They all look very similar. So to somebody who's not familiar with any of them or only some of them, the differences might elude them. But I think what's most attractive about it is its simplicity, and that's what pulls people in. And I think that the actual shell gamers are very much using that to their advantage. You know, it looks simple, it's quick and easy to play. Each round takes no more than a few seconds. So yeah, I think you're quite right there.
So what does it actually look like when you play the game? What does the sucker experience?
Okay, well, in its purest form, it's a small object that you have to find, which is covered with a larger object, and then you have two identical other objects that you mix around. So you might, for example, have three nutshells and a little green pea, or you might have three condiment cups and a little ball of fuzz. Or you might find that it's hollowed out potato skins with, you know, some other kind of version of the pea underneath it. So one pea, three objects, they're shuffled around and you're then invited as the sucker, or as far as you're concerned, as the audience member, to choose one of the three objects, hopefully the one that contains the winning object, i.e. the P. Of course, the operator will use a mixture of sleight of hand and misdirection and audience psychology to ensure that you never win. So it's a crooked game, of course, and you know, if you're playing it, you know you're going to be losing it.
But why don't you win? Because you know, without going into too much detail, of course, because we don't want to tip off the rubes too much. But if the pea is under the shell and I say there, €50, boom, that's where it is, and I'm right in that moment, why don't I win?
Well, there are a number of reasons for that. So you have to go back a little further to why did you even pick that shell in the first place? You know, why are you not shuffling on or watching somebody else take the risk and just playing in your head? And the whole thing is so heavily reliant on the audience management and the psychology of the game, and the fact that you probably, as the sucker, don't realize that there are multiple operators in the game as well. You know, it's not just the one person who's shuffling up the shells. You've also got four or five other people in the audience at minimum who are confederates and that are also pushing you towards making that choice. So for argument's sake, and in relation to your question, if you have genuinely chosen the one that has the P under it, which is highly unlikely, but if you have, you know, they'll use some kind of ruse to show you as a loser. For example, they might use sleight of hand to get the P under one of the other shells. So therefore, they can show you as a loser. They might also have something called a kappa coming in. So it would be somebody who's in charge of placing a higher bet than yours on a losing shell on purpose. Therefore, the operator can legitimately say, sorry, this guy's betting twice as much as you. I'm going to have to take his bet rather than your bet. Therefore, it's shown to be a loser, which has the added benefit of they can then reveal that you would have been correct, which cements the idea in your mind that you can win this and that next time you should bet higher. So, you know, there are all kinds of little ways that they can do this. The bottom line is you're never going to win. It's impossible. Yeah.
As you talk about it, the sleight of hand seems the least interesting part to you. Like, I realize some of that is where we are trying to avoid giving too much away because, you know, we're magicians and we want to keep those, you know, certain things secret for the, you know, out of respect for our art form. But it does also sound like you just, it's the sleight of hand is, yeah, I guess that's in there, but it does sound like the psychology and also, I guess, the sociology, that's seems like that's more interesting to you. Is that right?
Yeah, very much so. Whenever I'm asked about it, the thing that people care about the most and the thing they ask about the most is the sleight of hand. And my theory is it's because they don't realize half the other stuff that's going on. But also, I think people just assume that if I can just learn this quick little trick, you know, how can I move the P from A to B or something like that, that they can then go away and do this or that they could then beat the game. Mm. And the reality is, I mean, I've been studying this game for many, many years, and I wouldn't play. If I could see them playing on Jubilee Bridge or on Westminster Bridge in London, there's no way I would put money on this, unless it was to demonstrate that you can't win. I wouldn't have any kind of illusions of being able to get the money from them. And I think it's for me, it's all about that sort of beautiful dance that they're sort of executing, this sort of teamwork atmosphere where they've got all of these different people who have their own little jobs within this larger scam game. And when that all comes together and it's so beautifully choreographed, I find that fascinating. And it's incredible to me how people just lose their minds over this. So, you know, somebody who would normally never gamble might get suckered in and decide that this is my lucky day. I've just happened upon this, you know, crew of really bad shell game players. So for some reason they're out here and they're happy to be handing over hundreds and hundreds of pounds, dollars, or wherever you are, you know, which if you look at it logically can't be possible. You know, there's no way these sort of down and out people who are clearly rubbish at this game would be standing here just handing out €50 notes every 2 or 3 minutes. You know, if you think about that for a moment, you realize immediately that clearly this is a setup. But at that moment, you think, well, I'm just lucky that I happened across these people in this street at this time, you know. So yeah, for me, the psychology is definitely the most interesting. And I suppose knowing how the sleight of hand works, I respect it and I like that too. But I realize it is just such a small part of it. It's just the tip of the iceberg. And there's all of that beautiful psychology that nobody ever even realizes is being employed. And I think that's also because I was a street performer when I first started. So I took a lot of lessons from their crowd management. And I found that fascinating because it directly helped me to make more money legally as a performer. And it allowed me to give a better show because I could see how they were directing the crowd.
Yeah, I mean, behind you right now, you have many books on the Shell Game, and I'm sure, and I have the minor in front of me right now. And in those books, there are probably dozens and dozens of different moves you can do. When you perform the Shell Game, so obviously you're not scamming, but when you're performing this as an entertainer or as a piece of, you know, education, how many of those dozens and dozens of moves do you use in your routine? I can go first if you want. I can go first and tell you my number, because I know my number is one. I use a bunch of, you know, I mix them up in different sort of little different ways, but I basically two if you include this sort of shot glass.
I use quite a few, I think, because of the way I'm performing it and the reason I'm performing it. Now, if I was legitimately going out onto the street and trying to hustle people, I think my answer would be a lot more like yours, and I would probably use two moves. I'd say I use a handful, between three to four, three to five, maybe something like that, in varying degrees. I mean, I have one, you know, we're both talking about the one main move.
Yeah.
But I think there are finesses and ruses that come in really handy. And a lot of them are from watching Shell Gamers really work.
Yeah.
So you know which ones work and which ones are kind of a bit twee and a bit, you know, magician-y.
Because magicians turn it into a juggling act. You know, we want to we want to show off.
Yeah, no, not if you value your kneecaps, you know. You're not, no one's going to sort of tip the fact that you're skillful in this. I think in performance, a bit of finesse comes into it because I think you have to. You're there to entertain, not to genuinely rip people off. And people's perception of the game, but also their reasons for playing are different, you know. Although I can still see the sort of the gambler's red mist sort of cloud over some people's eyes, I can see that there are people I have to cut off, you know, because you can tell that they're going into that space where they get tunnel vision on it, even though there's no money on it.
I mean, you mentioned when you were a young person seeing the Shell Game and thinking, oh, it's a magic trick, and then realizing, oh, hang on, that's actually a scam. And I've seen that play out with police who would think that it's a busker and it's actually a scam going right under their nose.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, I don't know how it is outside of the UK, but here in the UK, when I've spoken to police about this, they tend to, in London, they're a bit more savvy. They tend to know about it because it happens a lot more. But outside of London, there's very little interest in it and it's misunderstood hugely. So people often don't realize that it is a criminal activity, or if they do realize it's a criminal activity, they see it as very, very petty crime because it's a fully grown man playing with three metal cups and a fuzzy bit of foam, really. I mean, it's difficult to take seriously in that respect. So, I think it's often misunderstood both by authorities and audiences. And I think in my experience, when I first saw them, it was amongst a bunch of other street performers who were also building crowds, but legitimately entertaining the audience. So in no way, shape or form were they scamming their audiences. They were simply entertaining them and asking for tips at the end of the show, hatting the audience. Whereas the Shell Gamers were, of course, scamming their audiences. If you can call them audiences, they were pulling their marks in and executing the scam to separate them from their money through deceit.
And that is, it's still a difficult distinction to make, because I have busked and I have spoken with buskers who have been accused of being con artists and swindlers, even though they're not doing the Shell Game, you know, or anything that even vaguely looks like it. But as soon as they pull out a deck of cards on the street, there's sort of an assumption that, oh, this shady character is not to be trusted. While I think to you and I, and hopefully to the law enforcement, there is a clear distinction, I think for the general public, I think it's much harder for them to tell the difference between buskers versus, you know, I mean, even say gamblers, you know, gambling a game of some sort versus what the shell game is, which is just pure scam, right?
Yeah. So I suppose, ironically, the reputation of the shell game precedes that of the busker in the public's eyes. So they automatically assume that the person, I mean, I guess that we're talking mainly about magicians busking, you know, a juggler on a 15-foot unicycle is likely to go unnoticed by law enforcement in that respect. You know, they'll have other worries on their minds. But in terms of magicians and shell gamers or Monty players, I think it looks so similar because we use similar objects. So we've talked about cups and balls and shells. We've also talked about cards, three card Monty, and then magicians with decks of playing cards. So, you know, all of those things to the untrained eye look very similar. And of course, to us, they look different, and we recognize the differences between the two sort of setups that are used. But I think it's, you know, it's easy for the public to misunderstand and to lump them all in together.
Yeah. I want to go through all the different objects that, because you mentioned three metal cups and a sponge ball, which to me is a magic prop. And I've never seen that in person. I've only ever heard people talk about it. But to me, magicians use a prop called a sponge ball. And so when you say three metal cups and a sponge ball, it is as if you're saying to me, yes, I saw a con artist using three top hats and a balloon animal. Like, it's such it's so clearly a magic prop. To me. And I think I want to go through all those objects, but I think maybe let's break down exactly what happens in the game. What appears to be a game and exactly why it is a scam so that people can understand it. So how do you, because you've done this before, you've explained it to lay people on TV. How do you explain the actual game and how it works?
Okay. Well, there are two parts to the game. There are the psychological methods that they use to pull the crowd and direct the crowd. And then there's the sleight of hand. And everybody focuses and fixates on the sleight of hand. And that's what they believe to be the big secret to this trick. But the reality is it's much more to do with psychology. So they are really pulling you in and they're selling you a story. And then they pull the rug out from underneath you. So the way they do this is they have Confederates in the crowd. The chances are, I think as a rule of thumb, it's a good idea to think of it like this. If you're watching a shell game, you are probably the only person who is not in on the shell game. If you're there and you're watching it and they're allowing you to watch it, you're the person they're after. Okay, so even if you haven't gone anywhere near your pockets at this stage, the chances are most of the people around you are part of the gang that's playing this. You'll often notice this, not always, but very often, especially in London, they'll be speaking to each other in a foreign language. It sort of goes unnoticed because lots of tourists are standing around. But it's a bit of a coincidence that the operator, the person playing the game itself, moving the objects around, seems to know the exact language that everybody else in the crowd seems to speak, even in an English-speaking country. So That often happens, so you can spot them. And the more you watch the game, the more you start to realize who is and who isn't in on it. But in its bare bones, we're basically dealing with an operator, a person who is shuffling the objects. Then we've got some bystanders or shills, people who are playing the game with the operator to pull a crowd. So these are the people you'll traditionally see win and lose in some cases. And they'll be the people who are really doing a lot of the psychological work of pulling in the mark, the person they're going to rip off. And then you've got lookouts, usually at the end of the street or at the end of the bridge, depending on where it's being played. So that's the traditional setup. When somebody comes over and has a look at the game, if they feel like this is somebody they would like to use the game on, if they're looking to separate them from their money, they will ask them to bet, usually with a minimum bet of, in England, it's £50, €50, $50, probably $20. They play for high amounts because they're not going to play 5, 10, 15 rounds of this game. They're going to play one round, they're going to take you for everything, and then they're going to get rid of you quickly. They're going to move you on and use somebody new, because they realize that if you're going to play over an extended period of time, you're unlikely to cough up a great deal more on the second and third time of losing. So that becomes difficult for them. And then once they've asked you to bet, you have to hand over the money. So they'll be holding the money and they're holding the three objects that they're shuffling around. You get all kinds of objects. We should mention it's not just metal cups. You can have hollowed out potatoes, nutshells, bottle caps, you name it. Anything that you can hide a smaller object underneath, they'll use those to shuffle them around. And it can be played on the ground, on a table, on a cardboard box. I've seen people play it with a little cardboard board that they're holding in their hands. So it comes in all different shapes and sizes. So once they've shuffled around these three objects, this is where you have to place your bet. You have to decide which one you'd like to turn over. Whichever one you turn over, it's very unlikely that you're going to get the P. Even if you did select the one that had the P or the ball or the other object under it, they're not going to allow you to turn it. You know, there's always a way to get away with it. In most cases, they don't even allow you to pick a cup until they've stolen the P out. So therefore, you're choosing from three empty cups, and they'll sneak the object in after you've turned your one over. So that's the bare bones of it. The psychology of it is really sneaky. They push you in, and you might find that somebody in the crowd befriends you, and that person will ask you to bet their money. So they'll often ask you to choose which cup they should turn with their money. So that way you get that feeling of winning, even though it wasn't your money up, and you think, oh, if only that had been my £50 note.
Yeah, yes.
You know, so there's some really sneaky
choice.
That's
genius. That particular, I know it seems really simple, but the idea of someone saying, oh, I don't know where it is, where do you think it is? And then them betting, so you choose a shell, money is bet, and somebody wins, and it's not you, and it's as basically as close to winning as you can possibly get. In the you
absolutely
know, like money changes hands, a bet is made, someone else wins, you made the choice, and it's I've seen it like when you I've seen it play out in real. This was actually with the three disc Monty, but yeah, but that idea just like the look on their face is like I came so close to winning. That they just can't believe that they weren't the one who made, like, you'd be stupid not to bet.
Yeah, and they only let one person bet at a time. So they're not taking bets from everybody in the crowd. So it's one person at a time. That means if you weren't quick enough, you know, you're the mark. They'll make you feel like you should have put your money down earlier. So they're creating like a scarcity. They're making you feel like you're under time pressure, which makes you make much rasher decisions. But what they also will do is they will ask one of their shills or confederates to bet, and they'll bet on the wrong one, so they'll lose. And you'll see that, you know, this seems like a stupid choice to you, you know. So, for example, let's say the P looks like it went under the middle cup. One of the confederates will bet on the right-hand cup, and you're looking at them thinking, this can't be right. Well, why would you go for that when it's so obviously in the middle? And then they turn it over and it actually was in the middle. So that's another way that you're watching other people lose and thinking, oh, that was a silly mistake. You know, why did you do that? I would have done this one. And then you'll prove to be right as well. So that's a double layered sort of way of proving that you would be good at this game if you did play. We see this a lot on Instagram at the moment and some of the other social media. So when you see like an advert for a game, you know, they're sort of quite basic games, and you see people making bad mistakes. You never see people playing the game and winning, because then you think that's easy. You always see them playing the game and making a silly decision and thinking, well, if I was playing that, that's not what I would do. And I think that's designed to make you download the game and play it, because you think, well, this person's obviously an idiot. I'd be able to do it, so I'm going to download it and have a go, you know, just to prove that I could.
Yeah, you're talking like sort of mobile puzzle games.
Where exactly.
You know, can you rescue the princess? You know, by pulling out the keys, or the lava is going to, and you watch. You go, you pull out key one and key two, and then the lava will flow down here, and then it fails, and you're infuriated, and you want to download it straight away. Exactly. Yeah,
and it is infuriating because they're making a stupid mistake, and you feel like you want to correct that. You know, it's very difficult to just let that sit and accept the fact that somebody made a stupid mistake, and therefore that's the end of it. You know, you sort of, I think as humans, we're drawn to wanting to complete that puzzle, to finish that, that situation on a high.
And it does buy into that very human idea of you. Of I think this is from How to Win Friends and Influence People, but you give somebody a reputation to live up to. You don't kind of say, can you win the game, or I bet you can. You basically say to them, you're the person who's going to win this game, and you say it all via subtext because it's less suspicious that way, but you give them this reputation in their head of being the master solver of the puzzle or the winner of the game before they've even started, right?
Yeah, totally. And you're setting them up to be the hero. You know, you're just by having a bunch of people around who are all losing because they're making idiotic mistakes. that makes you feel like, well, if I get this right, everyone's going to think I'm a genius, you know, and I'm going to walk away with the, you know, the £100 or the $100 or whatever the stake was. You know, you're going to walk away the winner. Who doesn't want to feel like that? You know, everybody wants that. So it plays into our sort of really sort of basic need to look and feel important and to win, to be successful.
What type of people do you see? Because we don't have it in Australia. It doesn't exist. I've seen a handful of people trying it out over the years, and it, you know, they don't last very long because we are, you know, I'm in Australia. It is quite difficult to get into Australia. People aren't going to spend the money on an airfare and a visa to come in only to get arrested and kicked out for playing this game. So I haven't had the opportunity. My experiences of the game have been to spend a couple of days in various cities around the world, whereas you, obviously living in the UK, you've been able to watch this game play out over and over and over again. And you must see certain types of people getting scammed over and over and over again. Is there a demographic that is more likely to be scammed with this game?
Yes, I suppose there is, but that's more situational, I suppose. So I watch the game for almost 10 years, practically daily, every couple of days I'd see it. And predominantly we're talking about tourists. And that's why the stakes are so high, I think, and why it's so easy for them to command such high stakes for each bet, because they've landed in London, they've gone to the cash point, they've withdrawn their holiday cash for that week. You know, they've gone to the bureau de change and come back with a stack of notes, bills. And so therefore they're much more drawn to the idea of, well, look, if I've got, say, £500 for this week, that I'm going to use for this holiday to have a great time with, you know, if I just put down 100 or 200, I could double that, you know, and then I'm so much better off for the rest of the week. So I think therefore that dialogue's happening, which makes it easier. And because you're a tourist and you're somebody who's landed in a city that you don't know if this is normal. And if you see lots of people playing the shell game, you know, I'm on some of the London bridges, you might see 10 people in a row playing this game. It's on masse. So it feels okay, because if nobody's shutting it down, if nobody's stopping it, therefore, you know, why wouldn't we play? There's loads of other people standing around, so it feels safe.
Why aren't they shutting it down, though? This is what I don't understand, because I spent some time in Paris, and in Paris they're on the watch. The police come and everyone scatters and they run off, and then they all sort of come back again. And there's a lot, you know, same thing. There's a lot of them, and they disappear and then and reappear. Whereas in London, the police were there and they weren't doing anything. They were just kind of watching and, you know, observing and wandering around and not really engaging. Is that still the case, or is there another reason why these people are able to take over?
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult to shut it down, actually, because it's effectively organized crime on a huge scale. So we talked earlier on about how it feels so innocent. It's just three objects and a fuzzy little ball, or, you know, or even just a piece of fluff under some hollowed out potatoes. It seems so basic that it's very difficult to take seriously as organized crime and as a big problem. The other thing is, so that's the first one, is the perception. The other thing is that it's actually very difficult to catch people at it, because they have lookouts. And especially in London, I can't speak for, you know, all locations, but the sort of the favorite locations where it's rife is on the bridges. So London Bridge, Jubilee Bridge, Westminster Bridge. And one of the reasons they like to do this on the bridges is because it's an easy pitch to control. They can have lookouts at either end of the bridge. There are two ways on and off. So they only have to cover those two exits with lookouts to make sure that if a uniformed policeman approaches, therefore they're always in contact with a Bluetooth headset with the operator or somebody in the crowd who can give a signal. So from afar, they're usually 5 minutes ahead of any uniformed policeman coming onto the bridge. So that's an easy way for them to just stop playing. The objects are not worth a great deal of money, so they can be thrown into the river if needs be. There's always one person who's in charge. They'll have a backpack on their front, across their chest, that's open for them to dump all the equipment and the money in. And then they all scarper into separate directions. So it becomes impossible for anybody to find them in a crowd. And they'll disperse, and they'll, you know, once the coast is clear, they'll come back. So even on the very slim off chance of that uniformed policeman being able to grab one of those people, the others will come back later on. And, you know, they'll just bail that person out. You know, I mean, that person will get a slap on the wrist, but it's not going to end the huge scale of organized crime that they've got around this scam. So that's one of the main parts. The undercover side of things, everybody says, why can't we go undercover? Well, first of all, that's expensive. You've got to get funding. You've got to put a lot of officers on that bridge to get rid of a lot of shell gamers. Now, we saw on Westminster Bridge when we filmed with the BBC, we probably saw about 10 gangs. Each had 5 or so people per group. So you're looking at 50 people plus all of the lookouts and maybe some spares hanging around. Mm. So now you have to have one officer for each person you're looking to arrest. That means that's a huge operation, 50 policemen on one bridge. Plus you're on a bridge, so now you've probably got to have police presence on the water as well, just in case somebody panics in the commotion and jumps over. So, you know, I think it's logistically, it's incredibly difficult for the police to shut them down.
It's and very, and very I hard. Guess ultimately it is, for the most part, a non-violent crime. In theory, I should point that, like, in theory, it is a non-violent crime. And that it's the amount of money, as you said, is, you know, it is a lot. It's 50 pounds or 50 euro, but it's not tens of thousands of dollars. And again, it's tourists as well. So the people who are getting scammed are leaving, you know, and they're not leaving saying, well, I'm never coming back to London. They're leaving with a colorful story about being swindled, you know, which is, you know, the cost doesn't seem that great.
That's true. I mean, it's unfortunate. When we were really sort of spending time looking into this and filming the games happening, we found that actually the money changing hands is colossal. It's huge. If you're looking at a minimum of £50 per round, and let's say a round takes a minute, and then it takes 5 minutes or so, 4 to 5 minutes to get another person along who might play. Now, on a busy Saturday with 10 groups on one bridge, you know, that means, you know, the maths just grows hugely, because you're looking £50 minimum every 5 minutes times 10. And that's only one of the many bridges in London. And it's, you know, they're clearly all working together. It's that, you know, they all hang out together. We found that the people we were dealing with on Westminster Bridge, they seemed to be related or certainly closely befriended, and they were working as one unit, separated out into smaller groups as opposed to separate entities. So it's, you know, that's when you start to realize the scale of it and just how much money they're pulling in on a daily basis.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I think my point, I think though it's still only per person, you know, per victim, it's only £50. And so, and it's, I mean, it's like salami slicing, you know, where they sort of take a few cents from each bank account. And so nobody notices, you know, and nobody cares. And those, it is a short con, and it's, and people don't complain individually about that. And it, you know, it in that sense, it doesn't matter if it adds up, because the individuals aren't going to all get together to complain. Yeah. You're just going to get a lot of little complaints, and I can see why it's not a priority for the police, despite the large amounts of money, because it's
absolutely especially with the effort and the resources it would take to shut it down. And you're definitely talking hundreds per person as opposed to thousands. With a minimum 50 bet, you will find a lot of 50s. I've seen them get quite brazen and take money out of a tourist's wallet. So the tourist opens up the wallet to check, and they'll just grab the whole thing and go, this much. And they'll actually place the bet for the tourist. They'll say, oh, on the right one. And then they'll turn it and it was empty. And it's so they're not particularly subtle with it. You know, when they're having a bad day, they'll be quite forceful.
So I saw someone in Stockholm, and they were doing that, taking the money out, but they were taking it out bill by bill. The guy was literally standing there with his wallet open, and the con artist was just taking them, not just taking a bunch out, snatching them. He was going one, two, three, and it was, and the guy, he had, again, as you said, like, I guess he was a tourist and was like, well, I guess that's how things are done in Stockholm. We sort of take the money out one at a time.
Well, it's quite a touristy thing to do, isn't it? If you're not sure about how much the money's worth, you know, you ask your taxi driver, how much is this? And then you just hold the a fistful of notes out and you know, you let them take the money.
Yes.
You sort of trust that they're good citizens. And in this instance, of course, you're dealing with the wrong people. Yeah, it's amazing how they can cajole you into spending colossal amounts of money that you would never dream of putting onto a hand of blackjack, maybe in a casino, because you'd think, well, I don't want to lose that, you know. So it's quite incredible how people who don't normally consider themselves gamblers will be drawn into this game and will bet considerable amounts of money as well.
I guess it doesn't feel like gambling, you know. It feels, you know, like when you go to a fair or a show, and you know, I don't know, you're trying to pop balloons with a dart. You don't think of that as gambling or even a game of skill. You think of it as you're just playing a game, and the money is the sort of price of admission, for want of a better word.
And it's framed as something super easy to do. It's not framed as something difficult or based on luck. It's framed as this person shuffling these three objects. And he or she clearly considers this to be difficult. But I, as the mark standing here watching it, I'm looking at it and thinking, well, this is easy. And you can't believe your luck that you've happened across this really unskilled shell game player. And, you know, as far as you're concerned, you've walked into a surefire thing. And all you've got to do is tell them which cup has the ball. And it was so easy, I could see it. And I've just, in my head, I've just won four times because I've seen other people make silly mistakes and lose. Or I might have seen one or two people actually win and walk away with some money. Well, of course, they're part of the gang. They don't ever pay out to marks. That's a complete myth. We hear that story a lot.
Yeah, the idea that, oh, they'll let you win. They'll let you give you a little bit of money to start with, and then that, no, they'll let you guess correctly, but they'll never, ever give you money. And if you see anyone getting money, they're in on it. And
this story a lot. People are constantly telling me, you know, my friend of a friend of a friend's brother's, you know, best mate, walked down the road and saw these people playing, and he was really clever. So what he did was, and there are all these sort of fake stories out there. I say fake. I mean, they probably started as Chinese whispers, and they've grown into these sort of legendary stories of you know, of success. But I've never seen it happen.
And maybe it has happened once, where someone got confused, or the guy snatched the money, or maybe the person did know what they were doing. Who knows? But it's just such a, you know, it's such a unbelievable. You know, it is the exception to every rule that they would ever give you any cash.
I think it's highly unlikely. Yeah,
it's also that idea as well that we think of, because they're not stealing in the traditional sense, because they're not threatening you with violence, or they're not grabbing something from you. They're you're freely giving them the money, even if they are taking it out of their wallet. You're sort of giving them permission to do that, and so we have this idea of it being that there is some sort of honor involved in these types of scams. Yeah. That the reason why they're not just hitting you over the head and taking your money is because they're you know, gentlemen swindlers like the Robert Redford in The Sting, and that they have a code of honor or something. And that's simply not true either. There is the potential for violence if you were to push things too far.
Absolutely. I've come close to it whilst watching them. They don't like to be filmed, and I was trying to get some footage, and I was, you know, I thought I was being quite subtle, but the particular person that I was dealing with was quite forceful with me, actually. You know, he came over and tried to grab the camera out of my hand. And so it's misunderstood both as the game, but the people as well. And I think that you're quite right. There is that sort of feeling of these are gentlemen cheats, maybe. But more importantly, they guilt trip you into feeling bad about what you've done. You know, you took the bet, and if you'd have won, you'd have taken the money. So I have to take the money. So there's a feeling of, like, you know, it's a matter of honor. You took the bet, you lost. And that's where the psychology jumps in again, because you have the operator doesn't have to do any of the smoothing over at the end. He's got a whole group of people who supposedly are your fellow bystanders and fellow players. And if all of those people who feel like they're on your side, if they're all telling you that, well, you know, it happens, you've lost, never mind, move on. It's very difficult to be the one and only person who's a sore loser, you know.
Yes. I love the when the crowd, you see them bet, and they're so like, oh, you really know, you should play, you know what you're doing. And you say, oh, okay, and you hand over the money and you point, and everyone goes, what? No, what are you doing? No. And they turn it wrong, and they're like, what are you doing? And they act like you suddenly go from being a genius to being like the dumbest person alive. And they don't. That's extraordinary. And because as you said, they won't let you just stand around. So I would, I figured out like how much can I get away with, you know, if I go over to these guys where there's not a lot on a quiet time of day, I can sometimes get away with just like 10, 20 euro, and I can bet and see what happens if I do this and see what happens if I try and do this. And so I'd lose this money, and I'd had that, and I lost the money knowing full well I was going to lose the money, and I still felt like an idiot. Like it was, the idea was to lose the money, and they still made me feel stupid regardless.
Yeah, I think it's so underestimated, the social conformity and the sort of the techniques they're going to use to get you to bet in the first place, to react and to act in the ways that they need you to get to flush the crowd, to get rid of you afterwards, you know, the way they push you out. And it's really quite intricate, and it's almost like a choreographed dance. It even comes down to just before you put the money down, they physically change their stance. You know, they'll move in closer, they'll stand up taller, they'll get louder, they're building energy, they're building excitement. So it feels really great at the time they're putting the money down. And then they release that tension as soon as you lose into, oh no, what are you doing? Why would you go on this one? Or, you know, so they make you, as you said, feel stupid for picking the wrong one. But they also make you feel like it was obvious that it was this one, and that you're the only person in the entire crowd that wouldn't have gone for the correct one. So yeah, I mean, they're really directing you and leading you down a garden path.
So I know it doesn't make a huge difference to the scam itself and to the people who lose their money, but let's talk about some of the different objects that people use in the shell game, because as a performer and as a collector of the kind of paraphernalia of scams and cons, I do enjoy talking about all the things you can try and use. So you mentioned metal cups or metal bowls? What are they?
They're condiment cups. So when you go to like over there, but if you if you go to a pub or a restaurant and they bring you some ketchup in a little metal cup, it's just those.
No, we have condiments in Australia. But they're just in a kangaroo's pouch is how we deliver them.
I think overall, I think the objects are almost always cheap but durable. That's the idea. They're looking for objects they could throw away. They've got to be, you know, they've got to be used on the street. They're going to get dirty. They need to be clean. They need to, you know, they need to be able to withstand a bit of getting battered around. So we're looking in London. We've got condiment cups and like an offcut of carpet as a mat with a fuzzy piece of sponge. It's quite literally just a washing up sponge that's been cut down into a ball. An inch and a half.
So when you said a sponge ball, I thought you meant the magician's prop. Sponge balls, right? Okay.
Yeah, literally a ball of sponge. Ironically, right. having tried using a sponge ball, it doesn't work. It's the wrong consistency.
No. I've seen routines performed by magicians who are able to do it, but I've never found it. It's nowhere near as good as you said, like as a piece of washing up sponge cut up with a little. Yeah. What else have you seen it done with?
I've seen it done with hollowed out potato halves and usually just a ball of fluff of some sort, bottle tops. So from a Coca-Cola bottle or something.
Apparently that's what's most common in the US at the moment. Yes. Over the last 10 years is like a bottle cap that's been, and they get rid of the, like a plastic bottle cap, right?
Yeah, that's it. And they sand down the edges to make them smooth. And, you know, because it's easy to get three of them, they're cheap. You can get them in any shop. And then they use often a makeup sponge as the ball that goes underneath it. And they tend to play that on, in America in particular, on like a handheld jewelry board, like a display board sort of. So it's got black felt on it usually, although the color's got nothing to do with the actual mechanics of the trick. But it, you know, it shows the pee up nicely, and therefore they can hold this board, which is probably about the size of an A4 piece of paper, I suppose. So they can move the bottle caps and the pee around, but they also have full control of where the board is. So if somebody starts to get grabby or snatchy, they can pull the board away, so they can control that. Whereas the metal cups in London, they play with on the ground, so they can control those by stepping on them. So,
and that helps control the angle as well, right? You can't, it's, you know, you have to, if you want to have any chance of seeing anything at all, you're going to have to get down on all fours and press your face up against the ground, the ground to catch anything, really.
Exactly. And even then, I think you'd struggle. I mean, realistically, they wouldn't play you. They'd move you on. You're no longer an easy customer. You're somebody that's putting way too much thought into this.
What about matchbox trays?
Yeah, matchbox trays as well.
Yeah. Have you ever tried using matchbox trays yourself? Have you?
I have. It's not for me. I'm not keen on the mechanics of the moves, but I've seen them used, and they tend to be prepared with tape. So they get wrapped up in electrician's tape, sometimes gaffer tape, to make them heavier, because obviously you're outside, it's windy. So it makes them heavier and easier to manipulate, and it gives them sort of an edge all the way around, something grippy to hold on to. So that helps. And again, it can be a rolled up piece of paper I've seen used, but mostly we're talking sponge. Again, I think it's just because it aids the move. I suppose it's a stylistic thing. I mean, that they can be moved around a lot quicker, and each of the objects have different pros and cons. Something you can do with the matchbox is you can lift the matchbox seemingly by mistake. You can perform what might be called a sucker move, or something that pulls the audience in a little more, that pulls the mark in. So you might flash that the ball is underneath one of them before stealing it out, and therefore they can see that, and they'll swear to themselves, I saw it under the right hand box, he made a mistake. So some of those moves are easier with some objects over others. So there's, stylistically they vary, but the essence of the game stays the same, of course.
Yeah. And of course we haven't mentioned the traditional walnut shell, because that is that's where we get shell game from, is people using walnut shells. I've never seen anyone using the actual walnut shells outside of a magic show.
Certainly not these days. I mean, I only see magicians use them. I use them, but that's for theatrical purposes, of course. So I think they're impractical, and they're very light, and to prepare them properly takes a lot of work to make them all look the same. So it's much easier to find three bottle caps that are identical than to find three nutshells that are identical, and you want to make sure that they are identical so that you can still create some confusion around which one has the P. If you can see, if there's a defining mark on one of the shells, you can tell that it definitely started under that one with a crack in it, but it's no longer under that one. Therefore you have a legitimate cause to say, hang on, there's foul play going on here.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about magicians and the shell game, because magicians sort of adopted what is this? I mean, a lot of what magicians do, we've adopted from card cheats and con artists and pickpockets and swindlers, and the shell game is one of those things. And magicians, as you said, usually do them with shells, like walnut shells. More often than not, they're fake these days. Like, they're molded and so on. Do you find it odd that magicians are sort of, I guess, stuck in the past with this kind of, maybe a variation on this scam that hasn't been performed in this way in 50, 100 years, and yet, well, regularly I should say, in that way, and yet we're still hanging on to that idea of walnuts, going to the extent of actually making our own 3D printed polymer, whatever they're going to be, walnuts. Do you find that odd that we're sort of stuck in the past in that way?
I suppose I find it odd, but not surprising. I think that it's all down to what are you aiming to do with it, I suppose. If magicians picked up those walnut shells and decided they're going to go out on the street and try and separate somebody from their money and playing the game for real, I think they'd change to more practical props very, very quickly. But in the confines of their show with paying audience members coming along to have a bit of a laugh. I think it's easy to build on it theatrically and to make it a more of a historical game that used to be played. If they were to play it the way it's being played these days on the street, I think it would lose a lot of its entertainment value. And it just wouldn't look as nice, I suppose. So that's yeah. part of it. I think it would also require them to learn a completely different skill. And in most cases, magicians like the sort of the forbidden fruit aspect of this game. So they're willing to learn something new with it to be able to perform it. But very few people are quite as obsessed with it as maybe myself or yourself.
Yeah, I am absolutely obsessed. How many, and you have to be honest, how many sets of shells do you own?
I couldn't tell you. Too many.
Too many. Yeah.
It's too many. I tend to pick up all kinds of sort of impromptu shells when I'm abroad. I found a lovely little set of antique helmets in Greece when I was in Athens and just used a little pee with them. So you can any three objects. Thimbles used to be used traditionally in England a lot. It was called a thimble rig. So, you know, literally any objects that you can hide a smaller object underneath and mix them around will work as a shell game. So,
yeah,
I have lots Did you go of through a, alternatives.
Are you, I've luckily gotten over it, but I used to just, every time I saw three objects that were hollow, I would go, I wonder if you could play the shell game with that. I wonder if I could just put those upside down. Do you still do that, or have you gotten over that yet?
I've got over buying them, but I'm still thinking it.
You still think about it. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. I think when it was Whit Hayden and the School for Scoundrels, I interviewed him on the podcast, and I think I wanted every single thing that he sold because he had his walnut shells, but then he had he was the first person that I became aware of who was selling these ones are gold, these ones are silver, these ones are pewter. And yeah, I mean, you can go back and there are people, you know, selling different versions for years like that. But I was like, I must have them all for my collection. And then other people started making them and I had to stop because there's just too many out there. I've got.
It can put you out of business, especially if you're not playing it for profit. It's
yeah. I think what made me stop was I bought the Colin Rose spun ones. They're spun wooden, but they're essentially just cups. They're actually just very small, very nice wooden cups. And I just spent way too much money on them and went, they're actually too big to use for the shell game anyway. They're very, very nice and they're completely useless and I spent way too much money on them. I think I have a problem. I just had to stop then.
Yeah, I think a lot of magicians particularly love to collect the shell game and they love the idea of it because, you know, as magicians, we learn all of these sleight of hand moves and deceptive techniques. And one of the questions we're always asked, I mean, I'm sure you get this all the time. Can you cheat at cards? Do you cheat at cards? Mm. Oh, I wouldn't want to play poker with you. Let's go to Vegas together. So there's that sort of expectation that magicians can use their powers for larcenous reasons.
And yeah.
I think, therefore, magicians are often drawn towards the shell game because it's a way to be able to sort of show that, you know, that sort of taboo side of things. You know, how could you use your sleight of hand to get money from your victims?
One thing I wanted to mention was we have talked about this as a short con, but I think historically there have been cases where it has been played on a large scale. Are you familiar with the big store? You know, like when they used to actually like build an entire shop front just so they could play the shell game.
In modern times, I think it's more likely that instead of building a full-blown business around it or a shop front, they'll use an existing business and shop front as a front, and then they'll have something going on in the background. The times I've seen it was in the back room or sort of towards the back of a workshop, a car workshop. Mechanics workshop, and they were playing three card Monty, I believe. So I'm aware of it. It's not something that I've personally been exposed to. So I've been very lucky to be able to sort of study the shell game in London on the street, but I've not really witnessed it elsewhere.
And you mentioned you talked about it on the BBC. What was that like? That was for a news story.
Yeah, so I was approached by the BBC and they wanted to expose the scam, particularly on Westminster Bridge. and they were looking to do some undercover filming. They needed a consultant, somebody to come along and tell them, what are they filming? Where should they be filming? When, etc. So we got together and, you know, I explained how the scam was going to work, what they should be looking out for. And they had all kinds of very exciting spy kit, I would call it. It was undercover cameras in glasses and in bags and hidden in watches and stuff. So that was great fun. So then we went out and we filmed the shell game taking place and tried to interview the people who'd lost money. Something we found invariably was that these people didn't want to talk about it. You know, they were A, upset about the fact that they've lost the money. B, they didn't really want to admit to the fact that they'd lost the money. I think mm-hmm. another reason why this is still going on and very rarely talked about shutting it down, because it's difficult to find victims. Victims don't really want to admit to it. You know, nobody wants to say, yes, I got fleeced. And yes, I was, you know, I was naive enough to play the game. And there's a lot of victim shaming out there too. So we found that when we were filming. And then when the piece went out, I was quite surprised to see that the overwhelmingly the comments underneath the video was all victim shaming.
Being out on the street for that long, did the journalists start to pick up some skills? I mean, did the journalists and those people involved start to think maybe they're in with a shot?
Yeah, so they were obsessed with the move. I kept trying to tell them, look, this is happening. We've got, you know, we had the psychology, which we've already covered, but we've also got, you know, the fact that they're speaking in a kind of a unique dialect. So these were Romanian shell game players and they were speaking in like a really unique gypsy dialect that most Romanians couldn't understand. So we had to get a special translator in for it. And there were all these things that I found fascinated. And all they cared about was the move. Can I expose the move, which I wasn't willing to do? But that meant that when we went out to film, they were desperate to bust this guy. You know, they would do anything they could to work out how the move was done. And because they wanted to get the right kind of footage, they were willing to bet some money, not a lot. Mm. And there was a particular moment where I told them they won't let you bet less than £50 because that was the minimum bet. And they just don't want to do it for less than that, because then they get into like other people wanting to do it for a fiver and a tenner. And so £50 is the minimum bet. And this journalist wasn't willing to spend that. He had 20. And I think we must have been in front of an operator who was relatively new to it. You know, to give you an idea, we were on Westminster Bridge and there were probably about 10 gangs on that one bridge. So 10 groups, 10 games going on at any one given time. So it was quite clear that there were a few people swapping between groups and that some might be learning and newer to it. And others were sort of seasoned pro operators who, you know, can do this in their sleep. This guy got complacent and he messed up the move. So it was glimpsed and the guy who was filming saw it and wanted to put money on to the correct shell in this case, which is a rare happening. In theory, they've snuck the pee out and there's nothing there to bet on anyway. You're betting on three empty cups, whichever you choose, they'll sneak it under a different one. This guy had snuck the pee in early, which meant that our guy was able to spot it and he wanted to bet, but he only had £20 on him. He was desperate to bet. And eventually the operator said, okay, fine. And was a bit shocked when he put the money on the correct shell and didn't know how to get out of it. So he had to give the money back, but wouldn't let him turn the cup. So, you know, everyone got very angry and we all dispersed. But
so he essentially, he made the bet and then refused to, like, took the bet and then refused to turn over the cup and correct. Just handed him the money back because he didn't know how to get out of it.
Yeah, so the logistics of the cash changing hands is, you know, the operator shuffles the shells. That's difficult to say. The operator shuffles up the shells and then you're invited to place a bet. Generally, the operator will hold out a £50 note and he'll hold it towards you as if he were trying to give it to you, which, you know, entices you to lean forward and to take it. And he says, no, you have to put your bet up. And then the operator will be the one who holds the money from both sides. So the sucker hands his 50 over, the operator's holding his 50. Those two are held together. Once you've handed over your money, you're then invited to turn over a cup. As I mentioned just now, generally speaking, I mean, there will be different situations. But in this instance, there was supposed to be no P under any of the cups. You bet on one, that's the one you turn over. And then to prove that you were indeed wrong, the operator will sneak the P under one of the other in different cups as he turns it over to prove that there was one all along. And then they'll keep the money and put it into their pocket. In this case, he took the £20 note from our guy, so he was now committed, but had obviously got confused and hadn't realized that he'd left the P right where it was supposed to be. So it was an awkward moment of he realized I'm going to have to pay out if he turns this one over. So he put his foot onto it, which is another interesting point. He was able to control whether our guy could turn the cup or not by standing on the cup. So he blocked him and just handed his £20 note back. And we had an interesting situation where a very rare moment where somebody genuinely had bet on the correct P and the operator was desperately trying to give him a refund, but he didn't want it. He wanted to turn over the cup. So, you know, it was a very strange sort of reversal of events. But even in that moment, he wasn't able to get paid out. They never do. This is why I say it's a myth. The bottom line is they'll either give you your money back if you're lucky, and then they'll disperse, or they'll just disperse with your money. I mean, they're not worried about that. There's no sort of honourable way of taking a sucker's money here. That's for Hollywood.
Even with a player who knows exactly where it is and has been trained by an expert in how to spot the moves. And with an operator who is incompetent and doesn't know what they're doing, and even in that situation, you are still not going to win the money.
Absolutely.
In that situation, then you just can't win.
Yeah, exactly. And we hear these stories all the time. I'm sure you get them. You know, people tell you, oh, I played that once and I won. And, you know, I won the first one and I just walked away with the money. And, you know,
yeah.
If you know how the game is played, if you really do know how the game is played and how it works, then you know that that cannot be true and that that in itself is a false story of success. And
yeah.
Those stories get spread and they're the stories people love to tell. You know, they love to tell that success story of a friend of a friend who managed to be successful. You know?
Sure. I guess it's a story that begins with, oh, yeah, I played that game and I guessed where it was, and it's and bet money is a completely different thing.
Yeah, I mean it's a better story than I bet that I bet on the correct one and lost. I mean that's
right.
Explain,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is. I think it's a much better story, but you know they're
well,
not.
Well, we
hero,
do, man. I suppose, but
that's just our sick minds.
I'd be disappointed if I played and won. I'd be really upset.
Yes, this is not what I signed up for when I played the shell game.
I've paid good money to be hustled here.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast and for sharing your shell game experience. I could talk about the shell game for hours and hours.
Absolutely. Well, I'd be pleased to be a part of it.